With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'll get you next time, Gadget. But for now, I'm listening to How to Kill an Hour.
You serious?
So this is How to Kill an Hour. My name is Marcus Bronzy.
My name is Funk Butcher.
There's plenty of ways to kill some time out there. Thank you for killing some time with us in advance. Don't forget, you can check out everything we do How to Kill an Hour style at our website, which is Funk.
HowToKillAnHour.com.
Simple. We didn't make it hard for you, did we?
Should I say it again?
Yeah, go on.
HowToKillAnHour.com.
That's right. Now, today we have got a guest in the house who is extremely funny. Please introduce yourself to our listeners.
Hello, listeners. I am the extremely funny and modest Dane Baptiste, comedian, writer, occasional actor, and sentient being, enjoying life subjectively as a part of a collective consciousness, you know, just like the rest of you.
That intro was amazing, you know.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's it, man. I try not to focus too much on titles and all this stuff. All energy is all dynamic.
Yeah.
I've been here before in a previous life. I'm back again, experiencing life subjectively.
What do you think you were in a previous life?
I don't know. I mean, energy can't be created or destroyed. So I like to think that I was a nice person. I try not to overthink it or try and, do I mean, think about land and title on it. I just feel like at least if this incarnation of my life is as human, then I like to think I was either a nice animal or a relatively benevolent virus. I don't know.
You wasn't a despot in your.
I feel like I wasn't a despot. I feel like I wasn't a despot, but it's just, I remember, a guy that said, no one's universally loved and no one's universally hated.
Yeah.
So I might have been in it, but some people were like, yeah. Those are the days.
Yeah.
And the rest of my cabinet that ran the dungeons would be like, oh, I miss him.
There's this universal opinion that animals are cute. And I was talking to a friend the other day about Watership Down. And that film used to scare me. I don't like rabbits anymore. I actually don't.
They were scary. Yeah, it was scary. But then it's like Animal Farm as well. But I suppose animals, when they're being, I guess, malevolent, they're mimicking humans.
Yeah.
Like Scar in The Lion King.
Yeah.
He's being jealous. Like, he's like, or like, that's a good one. Yeah, what's that other film as well? I don't know. There's one of them owl films, right? That was another thing when they were just doing all the animals. But people think mammals are cute.
Yeah.
People have a thing whereby, like, because obviously that's, I guess, insofar as the animal kingdom, we have a close link to other mammals.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, dogs and, like, gerbils and those stuff are all fluffy and cute, whereas people, it's very rarely people will say that lizards are cute.
Yeah.
But then I know a few people who be like, I've got a pet lizard or I've got a pet snake. And I'd be like, does that lizard even know you're there? Like, if you disappear tomorrow, and they're like, no, of course he knows me and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, oh, not too sure, man.
Yeah.
It's like cats don't really care about people, I don't think.
I think they hate us.
They do.
I think they hate
cats.
I think they have ultimate disdain for us.
Do you know, as a good point, a reason I think cats hate human beings because obviously you're talking about previous lives.
Yeah.
So you know, like, in like Egyptian culture, like cat-headed gods, and you see cats.
They were revered.
They were revered, and I think, you know, they say, like, obviously that kind of sentiment can be passed on, like, transgenerationally.
Yeah.
So I think cats have like an inbuilt thing in their DNA. They realize that they were royalty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they kind of carry themselves in that way.
They just miss the good times.
Yeah, they miss the good times. Yeah, yeah. And all cats are. They're just like lions and tigers and stuff, which we all respect as like apex predators and like being majestic. And it's just, cats are just like, it's just a tiger that's too small to eat you, innit? So it just tolerates you. It just tolerates. Once a cat gets to a certain height, it's coming for you, man.
So you got cats are basically lions with small people syndrome.
That's what they are. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they even, because you see, most of the time, lions are just chilling and we're the same, because it's like, comes down to it, I'll just eat you and it won't even. It wouldn't be hype. You know, because you know you can hear lions roar from like a mile away.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes when you see them on TV, I don't think people realize how big some of these animals are. Because like, remember, a tiger can do everything a cat can do. Because you see a cat hop a fence. You're like, wow, that's pretty agile. Like, they can do that as well. Yeah, like, they climb trees calmly. And they, like, even leopards, like, people understand leopards, they're as mad as predators as lions.
Yeah.
And they carry you into a tree as well.
Yeah.
And most of, and then the thing is also even worse is that they don't, because when you see like lion stuff attacking people, you think they're like biting them and trying to pierce their flesh. They don't do that, you know. What they, all they're doing, they crush your windpipe, innit? So that's the because that's the thing. It's not the sharpness of the claws; it's the strength of their mandible, their jaw.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's why sometimes they can like even do a little bit of pressure, and, like carry their cubs. But what they do when they apply real pressure, they just cut off your air supply. That's why you see them antelopes; they pass out because they're not wasting any meat, innit?
It's like a feline version of UFC.
They put you in a chokehold. So when you know what the thing is, like, so you pass. So when you pass out, then it's like yeah. So then there's enough meat for everybody.
Yeah.
And they say the reason why cats, yeah, you know, sometimes when you first get a cat. And sometimes you'll wake up and there'll be like a dead bird in the house or like the reason they do that is they say it's because they think you're too dumb to hunt for yourself.
Oh really?
Yeah. So it's like, here you go, this is how it's done.
If you're one of those owners that have no food in the fridge, this is your cat basically saying, look, I've done the weekly shop.
This is it. That's taken care of because you're obviously too dumb to do it yourself, innit?
Exactly.
That's why, because you know cats always look at you like you're embarrassing.
They do.
If you think about dogs, it's like, let's go for a walk. Like, yeah, let's go for a walk together. Ask a cat to go for a walk.
Nah.
It'll look at you like you're. Why would I? Imagine a cat shows up with the other cats. You know when the cats like jam by like the train stations and have the little hangouts and that?
Yeah.
Imagine a cat shows up with a human being. Like, hello, everybody. He was like, yo, what are you doing? This idiot who can't even hunt for himself. Can't even watch himself with his hat. Can't even watch. It's crazy. Like, cats, they definitely don't care about people. And also, another thing about cats, do you know Tom and Jerry and stuff?
Yeah.
This is a big lie that we have, like, cartoons and stuff stop telling kids. Because it's always like there's like a chain where it's like mouse, then cat, then dog.
Yeah.
Dogs don't beat up no cats, you know? Yeah. Those are, like, you see, because Tom used to get beat up by the bulldog, but I'm telling you, like, you see a cat and a dog when they live together, the cat is not afraid of that dog.
Mm.
Like,
oh, yeah.
They're not scared of dogs. They'll just slap it on his paw one time. Like, cat, think about it. Like, you've never seen, like, normally you see cats in like cartoons and stuff. Cats are always running from dogs when it's running from dogs. But, like, in a normal house, if someone's got a cat and a dog, that cat is not scared at all. He'll go, lie on the dog's head, jam inside of the dog. Like, dogs don't say anything. And, if dog, and then, you know, dog's all curious. They say, you check out their nose. Cats just slap it on his face one time.
Yeah.
They don't care.
I think there's only one type of cat moment that I enjoy watching because I feel like we get a little bit of revenge. It's when we see a cat fall over. Have you ever seen a cat drop a little bit or try and do like a nice maneuver from fence to fence edge and they drop and they go
they drop a little bit
and we look up at you like, did you see that? And I'm like, yeah,
you laugh. I laugh. Not too much though because that's another thing cats do. Like, see a dog, they will squash the beef with you there and then. Like, dogs have more of an on-site mentality when it comes to hostilities, whereas a cat will, you'll laugh at a cat and will allow it for weeks, and the next thing you know, it's like you're running for, like, you know, the phone, come out the shower, something like that. You trip, and the cat just cross, like, the door's just ajar, and the cat just walks past. It's like, sprinkles, help me, my ankle. This cat's walking past. They're very intelligent animals, though.
Yes. Well, it's obvious to you listening right now. Dane's a very funny guy, and comedian. Comedy is definitely something you do. Can we play a little clip of some of your comedy, please? This is you talking about 50 Shades of Grey.
Here is 50 Shades of Grey, abridged by Dane Baptiste.
Hi, I'm a pretty naive American young girl who doesn't know about sex, even though I have access to the internet and my friend's a journalist. Mr. Grey, you seem so mysterious and rich. Can I interview you?
That's right, baby. I am mysterious and I'm rich as hell. Can I put a pineapple in your ass?
Now, so that's just like a taste of one of the sides that you bring to yourself on when you're doing comedy. In fact, let's be honest with the listener. Do you want to share where that was from?
Yeah, that was from, I did Live at the Apollo. Last year, I was able to host Live at the Apollo, which was a massive opportunity and a milestone for my career. Because obviously, as a comic growing up in the UK, you watch Live at the Apollo and you see some of your idols and the greats going on there. So being able to host was amazing. And it's doing the Apollo, man. It's a big room, man. And being able to introduce acts was amazing. So,
do you mind breaking it down from a layman perspective? What is the trajectory for a comic like?
I mean, it can always vary, but I'd say the quintessential journey is like you kind of start off doing open mic where you'd be performing like above like pubs and like just like little basements and stuff and just anywhere there's a space and a microphone and you kind of just kind of learn your act there. And I suppose like it's very similar to a musician's journey in that like when you first start off, you're going to be playing open mic and you'll be playing like and you'll have like your single that people know you for. So in the same way in comedy, you have like your 5 minutes and that's what you normally do. And as you continue to like, I guess, refine and get your act and you perform more often, then if you're doing well, then you'll be performing 10 minutes and you'll do that with a view to be doing, then you become like the open spot. So you'll end up on a professional night where it's all pro comics. And you'll get like a little audition bit in there for like 10 minutes where you're proving that you can get into regular rotation.
Yeah.
And then you're kind of working up to doing the 20. And I guess most comedy nights work like a relay where like you'll have like pretty much like the kind of like the second strongest act will open and you'll have the less experienced acts in the middle. And then obviously the headliner brings it home just like with a relay. And it's like, so it's very similar. So you're kind of working towards, yeah, just being the fastest one in the relay. So you'll be the open doing the opening 20. And then, yeah. If it all goes well, after some time, you end up headlining in clubs. And then for most in the UK, I guess the path is you'll go to like Edinburgh or you'll start doing comedy competitions and then go to the comedy festival where you'll find a lot of industry there. And yeah, if it goes well, you end up doing TV work. And yeah, and then that whole feeds into you touring and becoming like a touring act and performing live comedy. But it's changed since then, I suppose, like because that before, like when by the time you get to Live at the Apollo, then it would always be like, that was like you clocked the game as far as like performing in the UK because then it's like
the credits roll.
Yeah, the credits roll. Yeah, so you're in there. So whereas now, obviously, like we're in a digital era now, and obviously technology with all takes a part in all aspects of media. So you can basically realize that from being online and stuff, and they have to factor in other things as well. So it's not just a question of if you've done all the clubs and if you whether or not you've been in all the pubs and stuff. So now it's like if you have a massive following, then you can kind of. Reach that point the same way. But I think in all cases, comedy is definitely something, whether you kind of realize your profile online, like some acts, or you do the circuit, you still have to kind of hone your craft and learn how to perform live. And a large part of it is not necessarily like you making jokes and people laughing. It's just how you can deal with like a room where people don't know who you are and don't have a context for who you are.
Yeah.
And what happens when people don't laugh? And I think, a lot of the time people are like, what happens if the audience doesn't laugh as well? It's a big part of it. I think it's any time. It's like if you learn to ride a horse, you fall off. You still got to get back on and continue learning. So, it's any sport, like any kind of, vocation that you enjoy doing or any hobby, like there's going to be drawbacks, but it's how you become a better person anyway. So, I guess it took me about 5 years to end up hosting Lively Apollo. And, and every single experience kind of contributed towards that. So, because it's like you're performing not just for that audience in the Apollo, but it's also for the cameras and for people at home as well. So, all part of the experience.
That's a relatively short journey. You just said 5 years to get to the Apollo. I know there's a
if little, you know, if I say you're 5 years. Well, good. But I say five years from I guess my debut show when the first time I did an Edinburgh show. But I'd say my cumulative comedy career would be about 8-7 years. It got me to get there.
Okay, so you started with a bit of life experience, and do you think that's helped to shape your kind of massively angle of comedy?
Yeah. Massively, yeah. I found the idea because I was working in sales and stuff before I did comedy, but I found it massively rewarding because. I think my style of comedy is observational, and I think a big part of doing that effectively is spending time on the other side of the microphone. So while I do like to broach like politics or like both race relations or like you know sexual politics and stuff as well, I try and do it from the perspective of someone that's sitting on the other side of the microphone. In that, I don't want to patronize people, and I also don't want to kind of lie to people. But at the same time, I don't want to like put too much on people's shoulders and stuff because of the fact that like. They have to go to work, and while like you know it's important for people to be involved in politics and all the mechanics that govern society, at the same time you know everyone's got to go to work, people got kids to feed and stuff, and we'd all like to be able to be involved in the plan, but you know people got mortgages and stuff to pay, so I'm always mindful of that, of not making it too heavy, but at the same time always reminding people that before their job and before their family obligations they are still human beings and you still have dreams, and rather than taking out a loan on someone else's life and being like I got to raise a family and project all my dreams onto my kids.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, whatever society calls you, you're still, like I said, a being a consciousness. And that's what I'm trying to reach, just so people can think for themselves. And if we all think for ourselves, then we still can become a collective consciousness. So that's the ultimate goal, I'd say.
I find it very interesting that you've pointed out that you see things from the other side of the microphone. So you've been able to, in essence, empathize with the audience that you're trying to relate to, because you obviously have to gauge whether or not they have the competency to take the content that you're going to give them.
Yeah, for sure, man. And also because like I didn't ever think I'd be able to necessarily do comedy for a living, because I grew up watching like BET's Comic View and people like D.L. Hughley, and then the first comics I saw when I was 15, I saw D.L. Hughley, he was headlining the show, Leo Muhammad, who's on The Real McCoy, And the opening, and the middle act, who's supposed to be, like I said, the weak act, was Russell Peters. That was like, yeah, that was like, yeah, 97 or something like that. And now he's like he's the most successful live comic in the world.
Mm-hmm. He tours a hell of a lot, doesn't he? So we might not see him. We might not see him on TV. Like, you know, a lot of people associate the amount of content that you see online or on TV with someone's success, but he is consistently touring.
Yeah,
right?
And he earns. And actually, he was one of the first comics to be on YouTube.
Really?
Yeah. So he was one of the first comics to upload on YouTube, and that's basically how he grew his audience. Because what happened was that essentially, like before, you know, people were able to monetize YouTube and stuff, and this is like way before, I think even like Rupert Murdoch bought it and then sold it back to Google. So when YouTube was like early, like still like bum fights and like crackers pulling out their teeth for like money. Because so we forget, like YouTube was the Wild West for a long time.
It was.
So then
it was the world star before world star.
It was not safe for work.
Yeah,
I was lying there, man.
Dave, what you looking at there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Some spreadsheets and stuff. So I'm working on the Kimbo Slice accounts. yeah, that's what I'm doing. But he was like, so he was able to reach an audience like before, like streaming platforms had their level of prominence. So reach an audience, and and so he's one of the only comics that's been able to sell out in Mumbai and stuff. And and what I like to refer to like is like the brown part of the world. Like, you know, he performs in the Middle East and performs in like the Indian subcontinent and like Australasia and stuff. And even though he's not like, I guess, TV famous and necessarily a household name to like his audience. And to an audience that, don't normally get to consume comedy from the West, he's very big. And, like, even when I first saw him, he was talking about, like, one of his... Because he grew up in Toronto. And Toronto, very much, very similar to London or New York, the very large population of Caribbeans and various ethnicities. And he's talking about his friend's dad, who's from St. Vincent, and the fact that people from the small islands, they always confuse singular and plural. So he was saying that his the guy's like, do you want to cooks? You want to cooks? You want to cooks? Four cook. And I was like, just like my dad. That's so true. So my dad used to go like, one of your children, take a sweets. And I was like, it's actually singular, dad is sweet, and not the time to correct him. But yeah. I was just like, could identify with it so much. And I think, that was a big part of his problem. So he was massively influential.
Yeah.
And like, you know, because I've just come out from Dubai myself, man. And, you know, when you tell people you travel internationally, people's like, well, people understand what you're saying and blah, blah, blah. But it's like, you know, I guess that's one of the privileges of being able to speak English as a first language.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, post-imperialism, you have most places people do speak English. Yeah. So, like, I was doing shows, you've got people from Yemen and Omani people in there as well. And so, like, for me, like I said, having that influence and just being able to perform all over the world, like, it was a big part of my influence.
Uh-huh.
And then obviously D.O. Hughley, in terms of like being able to like just roast people in the audience and stuff. And I remember he was saying to me and my friends, he was like making fun of us, and he was like, if I don't say too much now, you guys are kids, I probably get shot. And we were like, oh, we'd never shoot, you're amazing. this is the best thing ever. So I think seeing that as a massive influence. And then obviously even Leo Muhammad, and then seeing him on The Real McCoy, and then on my journey as a comic, actually meeting him.
Yeah.
And obviously, and he went from being Leo Chester to, he converted to Islam, now Leo Muhammad and stuff. But even him, I remember him being like, he had a joke when he, and as I said, this is like almost like 20 years ago, and I still remember he had a joke where he was kind of like saying, it's so funny that like this way people are, where people see like a lost child and be like, nothing to do with me. But they'll see a dog trying to be like, oh, all right, boy. And I was like, it's so true. And I actually think that like my first 5 minutes I ever wrote for comedy was probably like a weird Frankenstein's monster of all of those shows that I saw.
Yeah.
And I think when you start off, you definitely have an homage to like the people you admire. And I think in that same year, I just became massively into stand-up after seeing that. And then my friend Al, his mum brought back Bigger and Blacker on cassette.
Yep.
And Voodoo Child by Eddie Griffin.
Wow.
And I remember listening to those like over that summer, and I was like, yeah, this is what I want to do with my life. But I just didn't know how to pursue it. I didn't really come from a family with a theatrical background and stuff, and I grew up in Lewisham, so everyone else just wanted to spit jungle and like, or rap or be a footballer. Yeah. So it wasn't, there was no really like, I want to be a comedian. So
so how have you prepared for it?
So in terms of being a comic now, so I just think like before I wanted to make a decision, I think you procrastinate a lot before you do take the plunge in terms of chasing a dream.
Mm-hmm.
But I just basically, like I said, I like, looked at my predecessors and I was like, what they've done has been amazing. It's influenced me. But I just always felt like I can't do what they've done. So like, even if I was going to discuss race relations, I was like, well, I've seen Chris Rock and Dave Chappelle do it so well that I have to have a different angle.
Yeah.
And so for me, it was like, and also being from the UK, I was aware that the experience of diaspora here is very different to the States.
Yes.
But by the same token, like, I wanted to do a lot of research and stuff, because for me, it was like, if I'm ever going to begin a premise by saying black people do this, then I want to research every part of the diaspora. So it's not enough of knowing about, like, you know, second or third generation black Britons. Then I have to know about, obviously, if I know about West Africans, you need to know a lot about West Africans, mm-hmm. or people from the Horn of Africa. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and just, and then for me, like, my point of my experience, like, for example, just for that, is like my experience in growing up in London is that most people I deal with have been West African and predominantly from either Ghana or Nigeria. Mm-hmm. But then went to university in Bradford, outside of London. So I'm very far away from the biggest kind of hub of most like third generation African immigrants. Yep. But the guys from there are from like Tanzania and from Kenya and from Burundi, mm-hmm. which you don't normally see in London. So again, it was just, it helped me to expand my horizons. And I wanted to always that to always be reflected in my set. And also because I went to uni so far, and I guess that was a part of a transitional part of my life, so far outside of London, like I didn't want my narrative to be like, well, you know, this is, these are the cultural indicators if you're a black person in London. Because people, like I said, people are living in North, like living all the way in Bradford and in Norwich and stuff. So it was always trying to be inclusive and also have, and also have my perspective if I'm discussing, like, you know, English people and British people, and make sure that I'm aware of those nuances as well. Because I had friends who were like from North, and people who live in Doncaster are very different to people who live in Brighton. So there's a very big divide there. Yeah. And obviously a North-South divide as well.
Yeah.
And so it was all these kind of little nuances that I wanted to research, just so that everything I would talk about would have like that depth and have, and wouldn't be like a lazy comparison and stuff. So that was a big part of my preparation and trying to read a lot. And just, yeah, just basically it was a real process of unlearning, where I was kind of like, I want to be able to look at stuff objectively outside of, I guess, the ideas that are suggested to me. So if I discuss politics, I wanted to do it not along the bipartisan lines and be liberal leaning and make that declaration, but more because I just think most people don't really think like that. I don't think most, I felt most people aren't that binary anyway. So some people will be labeled conservative, but I'd say for most people, again, who aren't of a certain political class or certain class in society, they'll be liberal about some things and they'll be conservative about some things. And I actually give most people in the, like a developed country like the UK, for the most part, the benefit of the doubt that most of their stuff or their prejudices are motivated by fear. And most people want to be able to have, you know, a job which Brexit. They can earn. Well, yeah, Brexit, yeah, exactly, yeah. but then even at the same time, like something like Brexit is something for most people, it wasn't necessarily a surprise.
Yeah.
It wasn't a surprise for me. And I say that, you know, racism was kind of like grime. It was like early noughties, kind of went underground for a bit. so only the real fans stuck with it. No, but you think about it, like, it went underground for a bit, only the real fans stuck with it. And then, like, obviously, because of the internet, it made a comeback. And that's what I feel happened with, like, xenophobia and racism in this country. Like, it went underground for a little bit. Like, it was a bit quiet. And then, like, you know, kept it live on the internet. And then it's just bust again. And it's back in fashion again.
So racism was just played in the small venues.
Okay, right. Outside of London, innit? If you wanted to get the real racism, you had to go outside of London.
Okay.
Go to a few backwater places and the satellite towns.
Okay.
That's where you could get a little good little bit of racism. Like, the real people that stuck with it. And then a few movements started coming back.
And then we had Back to 95.
You know what I'm saying? Exactly. And then little nostalgic raves. And if you think about it, most of the racism that we're seeing now is really, a lot of it's rooted in nostalgia. Like, say, Back to 95, people are like, well, we want to make America great again.
People are like,
we want to go back to where it was. Yeah. Like, so, yeah, nostalgia is a big, and that's the thing. It's like, I suppose we're living in a time now where there's a very big appetite for nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
And by that token, like, that's a big part of it. So obviously the World Cup kind of brought back a lot of pride again.
Yep.
But like, at least I guess we're on the right side of pride. But I think for a long time, there's always that thin line between how far that the flag goes.
Yes.
But yeah, it's interesting. Even this summer, it's been interesting to see for a long time, the St. George's flag, it became synonymous with racism after the Union Jack.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like now, obviously post-World Cup, there seems to be a lot more about galvanizing people as opposed to dividing them. But it's that kind of thing. Like, it's paying attention to those, I guess, those cycles and those almost like a sociological study, which I find really interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, for the most part, it's, like I said, it's just things go in cycles. So, like, I suppose there's not really any new ideas. And like, even like 20 years ago when I was 95, like I said, it was when I first started getting into comedy, and I was very much aware of racism then. So yeah, I've also got kind of a head start where some people are like, I can't believe some of the conservative things I hear on the internet. And I'm like, well, this used to be, before like grime was online, this used to be live.
Yeah, so yeah, yeah.
you could get a live MC being racist and doing the PA before back in the day. So So things haven't really... So yeah, a lot of things have changed, but a lot of things have stayed the same.
Yeah, you've been quite active on Twitter recently talking about space, though, I've seen.
Yes. I was... Because I was in Dubai when I was finding out about the fact that the Trump administration are trying to start a space force in order to kill their... combat their enemies in space. And I was just like, this is... It's hilarious. It's like... They had that. It's called NASA. They had that already. So, I mean, you look at... I mean, on the one hand... Except for me, it's the idea that why you have a country whereby like you're not even prepared to give people like a minimum wage or a living wage, and that Flint, Michigan is a part of a developed country which is like near Detroit, and have not had clean water for like the last 3 or 4 years. Obviously, like a BP oil spill, and just the litany of financial problems, like opioid crisis, for example. Mm-hmm. So there's a litany of social problems that America has. So the idea is like, well, but space. So for me, I just find it funny. So rather than like stay morbid, it's just talking about the fact that like, if you think about it, like, you know, like Luke Skywalker, that's not an American name. And he has a beard and a hood. And he's currently living in a cave. You know who else did that? Osama bin Laden. Space Force. Yes. Let's find him. Let's find these Jedis. Let's find these Jedis.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yoda, that's got to be a Muslim name. Space Force. So there's that kind of thing, like, you know, Jean-Luc Picard, Patrick Stewart, is a gay. Do we really want gays in space? You want it to be called gays? Space Force. So yeah. Sometimes it's just like, I like humouring this kind of thing and just playing with these trolls.
Like he really watched Independence Day and was like, we need to do this in real life.
Yeah. Or he probably watched Deep Impact and was like, look what happened last time we had a black president, an asteroid hit the Earth. That won't happen with me. Space Force. No more asteroids.
You know, you said something that resonated real quick because of something I heard about the other day about nothing being original and Russell Peters. And I just found out the other day via YouTube that Russell Peters said he stole a joke from Gina Yashere. A few years ago, admitted to it. And she's, I don't know her personal opinion right now. I saw this. She wasn't very happy.
She is definitely not happy and she has been very vocal about it. So she's not shy about the fact that he stole it.
Okay. Yeah. And Russell's been stolen from apparently by Trevor Noah. What he's claimed. There's videos out there you can see. Sway has a conversation and you can compare it. What's it like at the moment? Because everything I presume you do on stage gets out there on the net at some point. Like I found that clip that, you know, is on a BBC website. You can find that out. So what's it like with nicking in comedy now? Because I presume it's always happened, but how does it work now?
That's the thing, because even as a record producer, we've got sampling. So is there a concept of sampling in comedy?
I think there is a concept, but it's just one of these things where like I feel, in that particular case, it's like, I don't even know why Russell wastes time complaining about it. Cause it's just, that's just karma, man. Like what? So like of all the people that complain about Russell, possibly, Trevor plagiarizing your stuff, then you are the one person who can't complain about it.
But,
I think there's always going to be like, you know, so the typical structure of a joke is that you have a premise in terms of like the what or the who or the where, and then the setup in terms of like how you're going to do it, and then the punchline. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of premises can be very similar. And so when people like say stuff like, have you noticed? Then a lot of the time we're always going to cover the same thing. And the best way, so it can happen. And normally the rule is like, by the time if someone does it on TV, then it's normally theirs, because that's what's going to have the largest audience of people.
Of course, online. Right,
so,
right.
So in the case of like my stuff online, the fact that it's online, for me, I find that's fine. It's almost like that's your security, because now it's online.
Yeah.
That means that you have a record of
it's like, your copyright.
Yeah, it's your copyright. Yeah. And also like we're in a data age where like you can record when it was uploaded, when it was streamed the first time. Yeah. So there's always all these analytics that can prove if you need to carbon date your material.
Yeah.
But I think for me it's kind of, I think a lot of people have very similar premises, and the only way you can the best way to guarantee is that if you are always approaching something with your own perspective, then you can only think like you. So it's very hard for people to, and also I guess artistically, then it's almost like, for me it's like competition, like just find the best way to subvert it. So for me, I remember I had a joke about Black James Bond, and everyone had a joke about Black James Bond, and obviously for a lot of people, I guess the premise was like, for being a black guy as a secret agent, you can't really show up in North Korea, you're going to stand out and you're going to be the worst spy ever. So at first, like, I heard a few people did a similar thing. And I was like, at first, like, is that the same joke? But it's like, what then? But of course people are going to come to that conclusion anyway. So it's like the real key is, the best payoff in comedy is that if you can take it where people don't expect you to, because the easier it is for people to see your joke, then it's more likely it's going to be kind of like replicated by someone else.
Yes.
So for me, it was like, how can I take this premise of the idea of a Black James Bond when no one else is going to take it. So for me, rather than talking about like that part of him actively being on the job, or whether it's like, you know, stealth mode, my car would mean you have to make it look as a white guy inside of it, which is, again,
could actually do that in real life. Yeah, that'd be, exactly. That'd be actually very valuable. That would sell the fuck out.
It would sell more than matte paint and rims. It would definitely sell.
Trust me.
Definitely
hey,
sell.
You got that white, man?
Yeah, exactly. I got matte whites.
Yeah.
I got ginger whites. It's extra, like metallic.
Yeah. That's an add-on, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like ginger whites. I've got old white men in Asia 40. Ooh, that's expensive. Yeah. So leveling it up. But it's yeah, so but for me it was like, how can I take it where people don't see it coming? So for me it was just like, well, yeah, if James Bond has a family, then like, yeah, he'll be the spy. But like, if I had a brother who was a spy, I'd be like, I'm not trusting you, brother. He's like, he comes home and he's like, I'm James, working directly for Babylon. So every time he's around in it, you want to discuss like normal stuff, like, oh, James is coming, like, don't worry, we paid for the sky, James. I'm the MI6 guys, MI666, Illuminati, James. And he's asking for scams and stuff, and like, yeah, obviously, James. Man's got like a parking ticket and, you know, come on, bro, come and get a discount for Aston Martin. Like, So, just taking it somewhere else. And also, my idea was like, again, it's looking at the theme. And I was just like, you know, are we still even happy with espionage and like spy stuff? Because like, obviously, James Bond gave it a very romanticized idea about how like, you know, being a spy works. But now it's like, when people are getting like nerve agents now, and the president is working arguably with a ex-member of the KGB, it's not really, doesn't really seem that fun anymore, really. No. Like when the guy crawls into a duffel bag and apparently kills himself, commits suicide, I'm just like, rather like they start telling us some of these secrets, because now it's like there was supposed to be a secret service, but now you're like, well, the government, even at a basic level, is keeping secrets from us.
Mm-hmm.
So again, talking about something like Brexit, you're just like, well, for everyone, whether people voted to remain or whether people voted to leave, we were deprived of a lot of information. Mm-hmm. So I was just saying, like, you know, I like the idea, like James Bond, like aesthetically would be good, but what I would rather prefer is that I would have a government that wasn't just still keeping secrets from me.
Yeah.
Because I just think, like, you know, you realise like obviously now how these things intensify, but it's like, do you remember 2 years ago when we found out that the government and David Cameron and everybody was like not paying taxes and they were all filing like their accounts offshore in Panama? I would like to hear more about that. That's what I want to know more about. Or like when the expenses scandal comes out and it's like, but where's all of the money? All of the money? Or like, or we had like a bailout and it's like the taxpayer provided a bailout for all of these enormous banking institutions. But then now, that was 2008, and it's supposed to be like a deep crisis. That's the housing, like banking crisis around the world, studied in like business school to this day. It's only 10 years ago. So that was a bailout from things that were too big to fail. We're talking about like RBS, Northern Rock. These are banks that shut down. We had to bail them out. 10 years down the line, they're reporting bonuses again. And I'm like, hold on. We bailed you out, so we are like majority shareholders of these institutions.
We should get a bonus.
Exactly.
Cashback.
Exactly. So, and for me, that's like, irrespective of whether you are right wing and conservative or you are liberal left, like, that's something we should all agree on, is that we have provided this. And so we should be benefiting from that. Like in the same way that, you know, it's like, in the same way I'd say I'd rather have a government keep secrets from its people. It's like when people say support our troops or, you know, help for heroes. Well, one way we could help the heroes, because again, and this is a narrative that comes from a right-wing government, like we should help the heroes and these are going to war for us. Well, then how about you don't privatize the NHS then? And then that would probably help them
a lot. Quite a bit.
That'd be quite a bit. For me, it's like, you know, we could talk about like spy and stuff like that, but it's like, I just think, everyone at some point, if you're going to need medical help, you'd need a nurse. And in the same way, it's like, we like football. And to everyone, it's like, everyone who supports football team is like, we need more money, we need more players and blah, blah. Because we all understand the fact that footballers need access to like the best nutrition and like equipment and stuff for them to reach their maximum potential, because it's going to benefit their club. And ultimately, everyone's aware of that business model. But it's like, well, then if you have nurses who like don't get a lot of sleep and have to go to food banks and stuff, at some point we're all going to get old. I don't want a nurse that's like tired and she's mashed up and she's worried about her house. Like if nurses were given like the same care and stuff, and really should be the same way as athletes, then it's like, that's going to benefit anybody, again, irrespective of your religion or your cultural beliefs or
I would love my nurse to have had that same level of physical dedication. Yeah, and like
scouts.
Could you imagine?
Yeah. Like if you had scout, like if doctors and stuff were treated like athletes and like they had like scouts and stuff and it was the same kind of system and we had the same kind of hype around it.
That would be amazing. Nurses would be in a hospital like 2 miles away and you'd be like, yeah, I've got a broken leg. They'd be like, I'll be there in 20 minutes. Yeah, run down there with a little bag.
Healthy, good to go, man. Yeah. And I think it's even strange that like even in sports, we're like, performance enhancing drugs. How could they? They're performance enhancing. That sounds like a good thing to me. Like as opposed to like recreational drugs or antidepressants, maybe we should be researching performance enhancing drugs a lot more because again, if we can prove that they enhance someone's performance, how would that benefit like the regular person? Yeah. Like again, if you have a teacher that could, you know, go 14 rounds with Mike Tyson as well as teach history, that would actually probably be a good thing. So maybe like, I don't understand why performance enhancing drugs is a bad thing.
They'll put 60 kids in the classroom instead.
Exactly. So, or like I said, if you have like these drugs that are very well and processed to be safe and they're going to help someone's athletic performance, then, you know, why is that not something that kids can get at school to help their performance and help their development? Like, so that's the way I would go with something like that anyway. So rather than just like focus on that particular phenomenon, I guess it's more the theme because again, like I said, because stuff does happen in cycles, like, there would probably be an equivalent years and years ago where, like, I probably in the 90s, like, I remember Chris Rock in Big and Black being like, you're never going to see a black president.
Yeah.
Because then this was at the time when I think Colin Powell was potentially going to be a candidate for the presidency after the first Gulf War. He's like, you can't have a black president. And then I think they were saying about having a black vice president. And he was like, there can't be a black vice president. If there was a black vice president, I'd kill the president myself. So what's going to happen? I'm going to go to jail. Will I be treated like a king for the rest of my life for having our first black president? But like I said, you know, you can't predict what's going to happen. And then now you have people talking about the time we had a black president.
Yeah.
So, it's just kind of discussing the themes rather than just like in particular stuff. And so to make a short question a bit longer, but I just think the way to remedy it is that if you just focus on your own mind and your own imagination, then it's very hard for people to kind of replicate that.
Have there ever been, go on, Frank.
No, I was going to say, do you ever feel that you've got a very important job outside of your own your self-interested reasons for getting into comedy, in the sense of we're in a social media age and it seems that, especially with platforms like Facebook and Twitter, the energy is quite negative. There's a lot of things that a lot of people are unhappy about, and comedy finds a way of kind of articulating that and getting through those problems. So maybe you guys are our coping mechanisms for the world's ills.
I think just humans, we're a social species anyway, and I think that's always been the idea of art, is that, you know, it's a way of just articulating our experiences, and that can be positive or negative. And I think comedy is just a very big part in that. You know, the dichotomy of like dramatic performance has always been comedy and tragedy, and crests and troughs, which is how life goes anyway. So I think comedy is very important because it's a natural thing, like, because laughter doesn't have a language. So whatever language, so there's certain different nuances of human language and the structure of it, which can vary depending on where you are. But when someone's laughing, like, it's unmistakable, like, you know what that is, irrespective of what language somebody speaks. So so laughter is universal language, and one, like, you know, which you learn very early on, like, kids can do it as well. So it's very much a part of, I guess, our makeup, where it helps us to, you know, have an affinity with other people. When you meet new people, a lot of the time you make jokes to break the ice and stuff. If if you're nervous, you'll make a joke or you'll laugh yourself because you're nervous as well. And then, like I said, the biggest part, I guess, is rationalizing. And, you know, that's what we say. If you got to laugh, otherwise you'll cry. So it's a responsibility, but I think it should definitely be a calling that, you know, whatever tragedy you're dealing with as a comic, or whatever you look at the world you consider to be morbid, is that you put this comedic slant on it so that we can all kind of process it a lot better. And that's what they say, a lot of comedy is very much tragedy plus timing.
And I mean comedians like yourself, I mean, I came across you from, I've been aware of you from your Sunny D program, and then I've seen your videos, and that's where we started following each other on social media. But again, I feel comics like yourself are very important because you toe that line of making people laugh but also educating as well and informing, which is a very, very important area in the kind of the age where we're in, where the narrative of angering people and that generating and fueling the kind of energy behind social media a lot of people have cottoned onto it. A lot of newspaper publications are aware of the power of outrage.
Yeah.
So in this kind of this PC age, mm-hmm. it's very important that people like yourself aren't curtailed in allowing yourself to kind of articulate and get what needs to be said out there, because it seems like everyone else now is, we're kind of muzzled. Whether you're in a creative capacity or a customer facing capacity, everyone is kind of like on their P's and Q's, even online now. Yeah. So it's very important for comics like yourself to be able to cut through that. And
but who can do it in the correct way?
Exactly.
Because I think you've said stuff in your shows about how other comedians have spoken about racism when it's a hot topic, but it's something that white comedians can't talk about, but they use a mechanism, which you can find out by listening to that comedy show, they use a mechanism to kind of remove themselves a step talk about it. But you don't seem to do it. You seem to jump right in and negotiate these things. How important is that right now?
Oh, completely. I just think it's important. Like, I try and just maintain a classic mentality as a creative, in that, like, while people are curtailed and people are muzzled, I just feel I wouldn't say anything I didn't think anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing, is that some people, I think, now are kind of now dealing retroactively with stuff they said before. So you've seen people like have tweets are coming up and stuff, and people are being caught, like, kind of being made accountable for it. And, you know, and so people are having to backtrack and apologize and be like, well, you know, my mentality's changed, and which I do appreciate. But mm-hmm. But for me, the remedy is that I wouldn't say stuff on social media that I couldn't take back.
Because,
mm-hmm. you know, you are, I'd say for a lot, you're still very much controlling your narrative on social media. And I just think that sometimes when people get into it, people have to be very mindful that, like, it's never, I guess my whole thing now and my approach to social media is that you can't take any of it too seriously. Because I even had a point where I'd get into heated debates with trolls, and then got to a point where I was like, yeah, but when you leave, put your phone down, or you go outside, like, I'm not thinking what, like, skullduggery 669 said about me. Like, I don't walk around looking for him. Like,
oh, is he following you as well? He's a prick.
Do you know what I mean?
So, skullduggery, man.
Exactly. But then you realize that it's like block. And I think I always, in this, but it's just, I think social media is almost like, it's just like an enormous secondary school. Mm-hmm. And when you're an adolescent, you have the kind of hormones of an adult, but you still think like a child because you don't have the benefit of experience.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing, is if you look at social media, it's like, for example, if you look, let's take like Instagram, like models, for example.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time in school where there'd be a girl in your school and everyone wants to be with this girl in school. Oof. And it's basically based on hype and it's a popularity contest. But essentially, you don't know that person's life and how and who they are, but it's just based on an aesthetic. And because that's the person everybody wants, everyone likes the same girl.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no different that you see on social media. Mm-hmm. There's people on social media, there are people in your school who you knew from secondary school, that person was hype, they might have had a name or whatever, or they were known within this small social circle.
Mm-hmm.
Once you graduate and leave this very small paradigm of, like, secondary school and adolescence, you see that person now, like, they'll be working, like, they'll be a bus driver, which is nothing wrong with it, but it's like, they're just a regular person, but there's just a hype behind it. And that's all it is that social media still recreates this aesthetic of an aspirational lifestyle that from a distance looks amazing, but you don't know. Like, it's like they say a picture says it's 1,000 words, but like 999 of those can be lies, and you wouldn't have any idea. So I've always just tried to have the approach of not taking it too seriously and saying stuff that I can stand behind. So there's a lot of people now where I think it's one of two things. We deal with this whole retroactive tweets and stuff. It's like, you either can explain yourself and say you were wrong, or don't apologize.
Yeah.
Don't apologize. So if you said this before, I'd be like, I wouldn't apologize for it. Like, because I don't say I apologize for offending people, because I'm just not someone that I intentionally do that. But I feel like if I said it at the time, I probably meant it at the time.
Yeah.
Because I, like I said, I had an exchange with a troll who was like, oh, but black on black crime, which is a trigger for me.
Mm.
So you're talking about outrage stuff. So it turns out outrage.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a trigger.
Yeah.
So he tried to trigger me, and he was like, well, no, my mum's black, and blah, 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 blah. And I was just like, well, let's see a picture of your mum then. Because why would you bring her up then as your justification for what you're saying?
Yeah.
Blah, 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 blah. And I was like, well, then just fuck you and your fucking fake black mum. The manager was like, what the hell are you doing? No. Are you crazy?
You're stepping towards that world now where you've got management that are going to be on.
He's like, you can't say that. You're a fake black mom, the producers. I still stand by it though. Like, fucking man is fake black mom. Because she's not real. Do you know what I mean? She's not real. It's like, and I said, it's like, in the same way that I find, obviously, even live comedy, you're making live observations, and it is like a sociological study. It's like, now online, you know, you are starting to see like subgenres, or I guess maybe it's a part of our evolution that human beings now have these avatars in which we conduct ourselves I guess the web or what have you. And yeah, so now you're getting subgenres of people. So the new one that is like now you get like internet veterans, like people that have gone online and talking about support of the troops and blah blah. It's like I fought here, and it's like, how do we know? How do we know?
Where's the receipts?
There's no where's the receipts. Yeah. And that's the thing is that like when I kind of stood back, it's like, you know, if you get into debates with if I get into debate with somebody and they're like, well, my views, this is my opinion, and blah blah blah, like, yeah, but you're not even showing your face.
Yeah.
So you don't even have enough belief in your convictions that you're even prepared to stand by them and show who you are. Like, you've put a pseudonym and you've put a fake picture. So even I know you don't even believe yourself that much to put it up there.
Yeah.
And like,
they'll take a picture of some sand in a hand and say, this is from Afghanistan, but it's really from Margate.
Exactly. Yeah. They won't even do that. They'll just go round and round and deflect and deflect. But like, what I would definitely say so far as social media is that like, in this age of opinions, is that, opinions are like arseholes, right? Mm. In that terms of like, everybody's got one, and you know, a lot of them contain traces of shit. Mm-hmm. And you'll notice that people aren't that ready to offer them in prison. You might find if your opinion is shared, it's a bad thing. So, you know, it's not something. And that's the thing is that when you think about it in that respect, because like I said, this is an age of opinion in terms of like where we talk about like just the whole narrative of social media. Like an opinion has no more integrity than a fart, you know?
Mm.
Because think about it, like a fart is like very brief,
mm-hmm.
and it can be very funny, and you're more likely to tolerate them if they come from someone you know. But there is a time and place. So when someone's like, I'm attached to my opinion, that's what they're saying is, it's the same. Yeah, there's no different. Like, because there's some friends, my friends, their opinions, I may not be with them, but it's my friend. Same way if you fuss, I'm like, oh, come on, man.
Yeah,
no need. Yeah, and that's the same way with opinions. Like, there's no need for that right now. Yeah. So it's just not something we take too seriously, because I just find like an opinion has no factual basis. And that's the thing. And yes, you got to remember about social media is that like, it is a stream of opinions. So essentially it's like a reservoir, and like with a reservoir, you're going to have a sewer.
Yeah.
So you have like the stream of consciousness, which is like what social media is, but you also have a sewer.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So what are the implications, not just for yourself, but for other comics, of technology like this for the comedy world? Because it seems like we're going into uncharted waters. Our generation, no other generation has experienced a time like this, mm-hmm. where we don't notice what's even beyond the Twitter or the Facebook or...
Yeah, we're not aware of it. Yeah, we're just waiting for the next one.
Yeah.
So I think the implications, it's interesting. I think it's definitely changed a lot of premises, and a lot of people will talk about their experiences where social media is concerned, whether it's like being online.
Is there comedy legislation coming?
I mean, potentially, but it's up to you how you deal with it. So yeah. Like I said, for me, it's like, I won't say stuff that I would be afraid to take back.
Mm-hmm.
So unless I was under an extreme situation where I guess society becomes a lot more autocratic or a lot more restrictive. But so far as where we are right now in the present, I don't say stuff that I feel I'm going to have to be like, well, and take it back. Mm-hmm. Like, I prepare to stand by it. So, and I think that's the thing is that like, well, going back to the analogy of fighting and stuff like that, you have, your body can help you clench. So that sometimes you might want to say something, but you realize this is not the time to say it.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing is that like, there are times when rather than me just be led by emotion, you can count to 10 and think, is it productive me doing this, and is it worth me saying that? So I think it's more about disciplining in ourselves, because social media is an interesting one, because I guess prior to the advent of it, we were all real concerned about the Patriot Act and our privacy being invaded. And then this phenomenon has come along, which has meant people now volunteer it. And I'm trying to explain, my nephew's like, he's 10, and it's like, when you get to of a certain age, you're not going to know. It's like if you knew what it would took for you to see the inside of like a girl's bedroom when you was a kid, when you were like,
I really thought you were going to go somewhere else. No. Wow.
Well, that too. But even that too. Yeah, but at the same time, it's like,
I think only gynecologists have seen that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if that it was a nurse, and I think that it was like. But you should visit your gynecologist regularly, though. That's important. But yeah, but it's just stuff like seeing a girl's bedroom. That took a lot for you to have a very long considered courtship ritual process. Whereas people are prepared to volunteer that information now. And it's just like, you know, you can learn, like, the stuff you need to find out about, you know, potential partner or someone you liked, you know, that came from conversation, having to learn. But now, like, and you'd be like, oh, a house number, the holy grail. Yeah. She gave me the house phone number. Whereas now, I don't need to see your house number. I can probably triangulate and find out what road you live on, which area you live in, where you like to eat, where you areas you frequent. Yeah, it doesn't take that long. So, we're just at a time of, like, I think we're at a time where we have an
science
abundance of...
Science fiction becoming science fact.
Yeah, a science fact. And we have an abundance of information, in which we are flooded with information, but we don't have is knowledge, because, again, that comes from experience. So we don't have the wisdom, or we don't have the wisdom of experience, because, like I said, we're in uncharted territory and we have no precedent for this. So I guess for all of us, it's kind of like, on the one hand, it's a mystery, and it's something to look forward to. And I guess, again, at some point when TV came out, the same conversations were being had, know, or even radio. So it's just been a very long gap where we've seen a massive shift in technology and how it can shape human society. So I guess this is what the art is about. It's about observing and seeing how things unfold and seeing how the fluidity of humanity is changing and being able to opine on it. So I guess it's like, it's a blank canvas that we can all, us to be artists on.
I think in one aspect, I think it can help, or I think I've seen the benefits is in the delivery of content from comedians. So, back in the day when you're listening to people like Cameron from Dipset, I think contextually, because we was aware so much of American culture, us on the other side of the pond, we could understand the language. We didn't need to be from that part of New York and understand the dialect and all that kind of stuff. So I guess the internet has kind of brought everyone together. So you've got Americans who understand UK slang.
Yeah.
And they understand the context of UK jokes and all that kind of stuff. So they're laughing with us now rather than laughing at some abstract part of the joke,
which is very good. It's a very good thing. And just seeing how like the digital age has benefited music is that it just means it's removed powers from previous gatekeepers who would give you reasons as to why this stuff would work. But now essentially there's no excuse, because like I said, you can cut out the middleman, no intermediaries, and immediately go to a point where, you know, it's out there to be judged. And again, you know, that's like anything, there's good and bad to that. But yeah, it just means you can definitely get an honest idea of how people view your art. And like I said, for me, it means it's just a matter of time. And it should be, and I think now, because you as a comic or any kind of creative, you can get stuff out there, some people feel this pressure that they have to have a lot of content all the time.
Yeah.
And I still want to be of the school where I still want quality to be over quantity, because now at the time, it doesn't matter when, people will find it.
Yeah.
So, and I guess I always rationalize myself where I remember by the fact that people say Illmatic is like one of the best rap albums ever by Nas, but it took a long time for it to go to platinum.
Yeah.
But if you make something that is good, over time people will find it and they will realise it. And I think it's comforting for most creators and stuff that if you can find a way of immortalising your stuff and having it out there for the audience to find it, I think if you build it, they'll come. So
in your world though, is there pressure because you've mentioned how things aren't as structured as they were before because of this change in the internet? So, you know, you can get TV deals coming in now, or Netflix specials coming in now, or you could tour, or you could churn out, and some people make their primary money off just their social media output. Do you have to develop a level of discipline when it comes to the way you organize your finances and the way you kind of project and plan when it comes to that sort of stuff?
I think it's the way financial management, that probably hasn't changed that much, because you have to know when to save and when to be liquid, and I think that hasn't changed. But I think discipline is maybe time management. I think that's probably the big part of it, because like, I think that's time, obviously, is something you can't get back, whereas you can win, lose money, or you can inherit money, whereas you can't necessarily get your time back. So it's more about time management. And in this time, if you are you know, creating a product online, like how much time are you spending doing that if you are going through the internet for inspiration and stuff, mm-hmm. and how much are you spending the right amount of time to engage with your audience so mm-hmm. they find out what you're performing, or are you spending enough time focusing on what you are creating to make sure that's out there and what distribution channels are using. So again, I think people are still learning by doing, and we'll kind of get into grips with how to manage it. But again, it's like any kind of business, it's something you can, you can either outsource or you can delegate, or you can, you know, as you exist as a brand or as an economy unto yourself, there's a lot of orbital economies where people are having more competence in particular things. So some people are good at looking at analytics and being able to have more targeted targeted media, and some people are better at like what aesthetic works best. And, you know, so I just think it's like anything else, like economies and different parts and the whole structure is beginning to build around it anyway. So it's like anything, you kind of start off by yourself.
Yeah.
And as you move on, like there's a lot of people that can help you. And so in the same way, it's still building society. And I think, even though it's a very individual act to like put stuff on social media and have your own account, in terms of the context of business, like no one does it by themselves. So
would you say that you're the last of the Mohicans though, in the sense of your trajectory? I see you as a purist, the same way I see a DJ coming from pirate radio into mm-hmm. commercial radio, that trajectory. Would you say that is lost in the generation kind of coming behind you? Are they more concerned with the numbers game now?
I think there's a big part there where I think a lot of people feel like their stuff is validated based on the numbers and followers and stuff. And I mean, some people are still purists, and I still have a generation of mine that they are still purists. And but I just think in any case, I just don't think things have changed. I still think it takes a little while to become an overnight success. Mm. And I still feel like, you know, some of the guys I've seen who have, you know, now realized the big profile from their online offering. No, because I know them personally, they've taken time to hone their craft anyway. Mm. Because essentially all of this works is that, you know, this is supposed to get you to profile, and it's not necessarily getting there, it's what you do when you're there.
Yeah.
So you can have a few funny videos and you can go viral, but if you don't maintain, like, you know, even just the small aspects of kind of show business, in that, like, are you liaising and are you interacting with your audience? Are you delivering on your product when you are actually directly with them? Are you able to, like, you know, carry yourself correctly if you are going to have other stakeholders, whether it's like brand partnerships or like producers or involved in TV or streaming platforms? Yeah. So if you don't learn that stuff, or you don't, like, it doesn't matter how big you get, you can be as big as you can and you can all go. Because, like, you know, I remember like Chocolate Rain guy and like Friday, Rebecca Black doing Friday, stuff like that. And these views and they were enormous, but I don't know where they are now.
So again,
it's not, I still don't think it's changed. Like, as human beings, it's getting there is not the problem, is staying there.
Yeah.
And I think that would be because at the same time, it's even from my generation, it's working out where we fit in. So while we might necessarily be posting loads of content on videos and doing clips on Vine, but then, you know, now we're seeing the prevalence of like podcasts and stuff where you get to hear the whole narrative, and it's very useful. Like, it's nice, man. It's like an adult slumber party, man. You have like jokes and talk about your life and stuff. And that's, like I said, it's again, even with podcasts, I think it just comes from an inherent part of our need for nostalgia, where you could just hang out and just talk and stuff like that, because we just live in a time where everyone's in such a high power state of being. We're like cash rich and we're time poor. So I think every time people want to get the chance, and we're a lot, and like I said, we are in a time of a lot more transparency because of like technology we have, so people want to know more about you and have more dimensions to your journey. So the fact that podcasts exist and people still want to hear about the journey is testament to the fact that things haven't changed that much. So it's a good thing. It's just like anything else. It's like, you know, human beings can use fire to cook their food, and then it can also burn down buildings. So like
to the word laughed at that.
So it's learning how to manage it.
Because
there was a long time where like primitive human beings, like they didn't like you taking pictures of them because they said it'll take your soul.
So
you look at something like a selfie, it's like up until a certain point, human beings were able to process their reflection. You only see your reflection in water, or so that would be the only time you probably see your reflection. So stuff like selfies, where like the idea of a selfie, you kind of look at self and then you kind of have to judge your appearance based on that, and give this thought is that it's what the effect does that have on you psychologically? Because then you could argue, like, if no one knew what anyone else did look like what would the concepts of what's attractiveness is and what it is and would it matter?
Well, there's that whole theory about when we look in the mirror, it's basically our brain recalibrating an image of ourselves to make ourselves feel mentally comfortable before we step out the door. So that's why when we take a picture, someone takes a picture of us, we don't like the picture that someone else has taken, because we haven't done the kind of
the processing,
the
it,
processing
yeah, yeah.
like our own mental IBM computers haven't shaped our nose and our eyes and yeah. and whatnot.
So that's what I mean. It's like it's like by that token, it's kind of like if that's not our truth and that's not the truth to them, then really all what we consider attractiveness or beauty is all a lie, really.
Mm-hmm.
And which I think everyone knows, but mm-hmm. at the same time, it's like a very different idea suggested to us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, I just think it's as human beings, like we need to ideally get to a point where we realize this stuff is a tool and it doesn't really define who we are.
Yeah.
Because we've been around longer than all of this stuff has existed and we were there before it and arguably could be there after it or maybe not, or whatever the next incarnation of our journey is. So it's going to involve technology whether we like it or not. So mm-hmm. we just need to learn over time how we're going to coexist.
Do you know what, actually, Funk, you actually got an article, haven't you, on you, which has some information about social media that's being, how, which social media platforms are being used and the percentage and stuff. Can you whip that out for us, please, Rob? Because I found that you might be interested to kind of hear who's using what at the moment. Mm. But you also mentioned, while Funk's doing that, you got a you mentioned podcasts. You have your own, though, don't you? I've listened
I
to
I do,
it.
Yeah, Question Everything, which is, yeah, it's a very podcast, a very basic podcast in terms of premise. And just like, you know, I have guests on where I like to just ask them a question. And then we kind of just riff on it and just, yeah, no question is off limits. And yeah, I just want to keep that idea quite basic and just enough where we can just stimulate conversation. And again, I just think like we're just in a time now where a lot of people are like, what's going on?
So
if you just want to ask anything, then let's discuss it. And I think that's a big part of any kind of progression in terms of human interaction will come from just asking questions and leaving yourself open to learn something.
And you do take it in some quite funny directions. I think I listened to the Reggie Yates episode. You spoke about there's a type of person in the bathroom. They remove, like, if I've been in the toilet and I've done a number two and I've left a skid mark, what's the type of person kind of, when you piss away the skid mark? I don't know. Yeah, it sounded like a really, like, so sounded like a profession.
It is. It's the urinary technicians, man. It's like we're like number six on the emergency services. like after lifeguards and, like, Civil, like, you know, like
KFC.
After KFC and after Deliveroo.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
and Just Eat and yep. Uber Eats. Like, so that maybe 12 on the emergency services.
Yeah,
then it's like the people that clean up the skin marks and that. Yeah, just got to do it, man. I try and leave things how I'd like to find them.
Mm-hmm. So, that's fair enough. Yeah. That's fair enough. We have got a question that's actually an ongoing question that we've asked many a guest on the show, and as somebody who I feel like you're quite open with us, you would divulge. And at the moment, we're standing at about 50-50 in the mm-hmm. two parties that answer this question. I'm going to set this up. So you've gone to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
You've had a number two. Mm-hmm. Dropped a good deuce.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, you're going to leave the place as you found it. I think that's a really respectable thing. I like that. Thank you. Mm-hmm. You're going to wipe your ass. Do you stand up or sit down as you wipe? This is a serious question.
No, it's an interesting question.
Because there's two parties and yeah. one party doesn't know the other exists until I bring this to them most of the time.
Right. It's an interesting one. Do you know what? Yeah. Based on my most recent experiences, I'm going to say I sit down.
Okay.
And I say that because I feel like, not to sit down, but you have to kind of squat. And yeah. I don't want to do too graphic in your podcast.
No,
I'm afraid,
go for it, bro.
But I'm just saying that because I just feel like you squat because of the purpose is that your body's, your butt cheeks are supposed to spread so you can go to defecate properly, right?
Yeah.
So then I want it to still be open so I clean my butt properly. But then I say that, but at the same time, like, I just came back from the Emirates and I'm just like these toilets need to have the rinses, man.
Yes.
These bidets, like all toilets,
bidets.
Like
bidets.
Bidets are so important, man. I'm saying this, and I say this with the utmost respect, yeah. One thing about the one. Bitching. Sick. Definitely on a ragged tip. So I'm saying your bottom should be on a ragged tip. It's clean and fresh.
They should play that in the bathroom.
They should play that.
If you try to get out without pressing the bidet button, yeah. that should play.
They should very loudly.
Shame you up, innit? Shame you, innit?
Outside the bathroom are like, on a ragged tip's playing. Someone has no hygiene. They should do that. They should definitely do that. I think it's... One of the great things about that region of the world is that there's a very big emphasis on sanitation.
100%.
Yeah. And I think that should be everywhere. And I'd say I kind of sit down. But then I don't know. I mean, but there might be instances where you'd stand up. I don't know why. Like I said, because if you stand up before you've cleaned, then I don't know, any additional debris might That's tumbled and get caught. What a terrible day. your day is ruined. I don't know. People usually, when you stand up, anytime when I see people standing up after they've used the toilet to do a number two, it's like, that's like a kid just like got a bit of potty and you got to clean it. And I guess some people don't grow out of that, you know? I think that's what it is. It's like, you know, when you go to secondary, you go to primary school and there's the kid who still puts his pants around his ankles to go to the toilet at the urinal. And you're like, your parents, they
it's to make you aware.
Do you know what it looks like? It looks like a full start in athletics. Yeah, you just
exactly. So it's, but it's the same as like, I just find it's like straight when people go to the toilet and they put their pants all around their ankles when they used to go to the toilet when we was all kids. And I'd be like, your parents have failed you, man. You should learn to, like, you need to learn how to, like, make good uses of zips and, like, the slots and stuff like that. You never know, because you can't do that. If you do that now by a tree, you could be on a register for that. So your parents should teach you doing that as well, man. Like, personal responsibility.
Did you know there were standards out there till I asked you that question? Because some standards don't know their sitters and sitters don't know their standards.
I didn't know standards. But if you stand tall, I mean, I guess if you're white, but then if you're going, I guess you're riping, when you're riping front to back, I guess standing's going to be okay. But I don't know, man. Standing seems strange.
Have you ever been in the room knowing there's a stander in the room?
No.
I'll make you aware our producer Billy is...
He's got a stats.
He's a stander. He wants to try and explain himself, but he tries this.
I'm not the only stander.
I'm not alone. We're a community.
Rally my standers.
Remember back to the episode with Ramel. Funk admitted to standing up as well.
So Funk's a stander. Did I? So we're at 50-50.
All right, my only question
for Ramel is a stander.
Ramel, okay, yeah. I get that. Okay. But then how do you stand if like you got your trousers down?
Without falling over in like a comedic sort of...
No,
like,
I don't stand. I crouch in Tiger.
I'll crouch,
okay,
I get.
Okay, so he's a crouch.
I crouch, I get.
And Ori Starter says he's a stand, crouch, stand and crouch to finish off. There's some combos out there.
There's a real combos
he's
out
kind
there.
Of, he's straddling the line quite literally.
I want to caveat by saying I'm more of a try and do it before I leave my house.
So then
it's nobody's business. But yeah, I mean, I can do either. I think it's about being pragmatic in that particular respect.
Yeah.
Standard, croucher, lunger, whatever it takes, man. Like festivals, you might need to know how to lunge.
Yeah.
I think festivals are probably a good place to stand.
Yeah.
I think actually having the strength, because even though I may not necessarily default to stand, if the occasion calls, it's important to be able to stand.
Yeah.
Like you do Glastonbury or stuff like that, you want to be able to stand.
I think I'm going to go for the just try not to eat for 4 days.
Like, oh yeah. Oh, I went to a festival last year. I didn't eat for 72 hours. I didn't use the toilet for 72 hours.
Bad when you're there, but when you finally got onto the toilet, must have been a wonderful experience.
It was like reaching the top of Everest. It's like, I've earned this. And you know, people are like, that's not healthy. I don't care. Like, even if 20 years down the line, the doctor's like, oh no, like, you maybe should have. I'd be like, nope, worth it. Because I'm paying for you now, doc. But if I hadn't held on for 72 hours, I'd be having this conversation with a therapist. So I'd rather be you just help me, give me the laxatives, bro.
Yeah. All right, Dane. Before you even decide to step out of here, please, I want you to let the audience know what you have coming up in your career at the moment, and also how we can get in contact with you, because I know you're busy.
Cool. I am on all of your socials. I'd say I probably frequent Instagram and Twitter more often if you want to have conversation and find content is available on my Facebook page as well as YouTube channel and Instagram as well. I am always gigging, so you can find all of my list of gigs on danebaptiste.co.uk, and I begin my one-man tour of my show Gold, Oil and Drugs on September the 19th again. So again, find a venue near you and it'd be great to see all of you. And in the meantime, find me on the socials, man. I'm about and stay in touch, and find the listings online and all are welcome.
Cool. One more thing before we let you get out of here. Funk's got that actual article up now about social media, so it's quite good actually. You've let everyone know what your social medias are. You're now going to find out where most of the audiences are as well.
So this article I saw online, actually was a clipping that was sent to me, and it basically just talks about the amount of users, active users, that have been added over, I guess, the calendar year. And Instagram, Facebook and WhatsApp are literally kicking everyone's butts at the moment. They've gained more users than Snapchat and Twitter combined.
Mm.
And interestingly enough, Instagram, Facebook and WhatsApp are all owned by the same company.
Mm.
And
that's interesting.
The thing I found interesting was the most used is obviously Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of reminded me back in the day when you were at school, there was all those kids that like the picture books. as opposed to the books with the words.
Well, Instagram is the new television. This is why it's successful. Like
IGTV.
Exactly. And also, but then, and I say it as well because if you look at the word Instagram, the suffix of it is gram. Now, if it was about pictures, it'd be called graph. Same thing with TV. It's like, you know, it's like it's television or it's like television programming.
Yeah.
So Instagram is very similar in the fact that like it's no different to TV in that what you see are very high color, very beautiful images of very aspirational lifestyles that you that people aspire to. And that's what TV is like. You watch TV, it's like, ah, I got that in common, or I want to go there one day, I want to have that car. And the only difference is, and that's the message I gave about social networking, is that the TV is regulated because it's been around for longer.
Yeah.
So when you see stuff on TV, like if you see an aspirational image or like a car and stuff, it will say like either this car is the like the top line version, or this car on the road costs this much money, or this person is an actress and blah, blah.
Yeah.
So we don't really see that on Instagram.
Yeah.
So my advice to people with Instagram stuff like that is to remember that, like, you know, just with TV, don't try this at home.
Exactly.
Or like this has been embellished for comedic effect.
This CEO is a laugh now, isn't it? Like the consumers are literally not paying attention to the semantics.
They're not.
So the CEO's like, so we put it out there for you.
It's called
Instagram.
Exactly. Yeah. And people. But then the thing is, what you'll find is that they'll take like a very attractive person and they'll say, oh well, I'm using this charcoal toothpaste, or I'm using this weight loss tea. But you know, you don't know if that person's had lipo, you don't know if that's been photoshopped. So this is where you see a lot of pressure now with people saying you have to at least give people, especially children who have no frame of reference when they're going on social networks, that this stuff has been created, this aesthetic has been created for the purposes of commerce. Because on TV you know when the adverts are, but on Instagram you don't know when a feed ends and an advert begins. So yeah, it's interesting that I think it's called Instagram instead of Instagraph.
Yeah, and it's interesting because obviously in the real physical world, there's actually legislation to protect against false advertising and rogue traders.
Exactly, but they're still finding a way around that with social networking. And so like I think it's fine. I think once we have more of an understanding of it, there needs to be that kind of regulation.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we can ever really regulate the internet like that though? Really?
Well, to an extent, I mean, the internet is at this stage, it's just holding up, you know, it's just showing you humanity in a mirror. So can you completely regulate humanity? Like most people say, you don't want it to happen. So I think, the internet is, there's the good and the bad, and you just need to, like I said, with more experience and the more of a frame of reference we have, we'll learn to be able to say, no, where we go and where we don't go. Like, you know, like in The Lion King, it was like, we don't go over there. Don't go. So like, for example, I don't go on like worldstarhiphop.com or rotten.com because I know, the videos, if I read enough comments on World Star Hip Hop, I'm going to start hating the world. So this isn't the point. There's no point in putting myself in a position where I'm going to be upset, or at least I'm going to have a frame of mind where I can process this stuff without getting too angry or getting too indignant about it. In the same way that, you know, you look at news channels or any kind of feed now, because I said there's now people trying to manipulate this zeitgeist of outrage. And I think it's a good, and I think, you know, that again is a reflection of the fact that even though we are in such a new world, human beings haven't changed that much. Because I'd say, you know, you look at issues with mental health and stuff like that, it's like not surprising that we live in a time where you can be bombarded with information from everywhere. It's a lot to process, and that's going to sometimes have negative effects on people and affect their concentration and stuff. So I think the more we learn about it, the more we can use it to our advantage and use like anything good in moderation.
I mean, depression's been around from day dot.
Yeah,
I mean, Van Gogh cut off his ear because of depression.
This is it. So,
I mean, it's interesting you say about the whole mirror aspect of it being a reflection of us, because I was having this conversation in private about the way Instagram and social media itself is just democracy. It pushes out all this content. You pick, and the stuff you picked keeps coming back at you. That's what it does. That's why it comes up on the top of your feed, because you've picked the guy with the muscles. You've picked the picturesque island. You've picked the sports car, and it's giving you more of that stuff.
Everything I've just liked on Instagram.
Yeah, exactly. They're giving you the algorithm, but then at the same time, it's very similar to TV in that it's like sometimes stuff is suggested to you.
Yes.
Even though you didn't necessarily ask for it, because it's not just a function of supply and demand. Mm. Now it's like they can take stuff like, you know, just based on this demographic of people, and normally a lot of them like this, like, maybe we can. And also maybe your phone has Siri and all this stuff like now. So yeah, you can turn Siri off, but you don't know if it's necessarily off.
Yeah.
So your phone as well is now receiving your narrative, which means that it can now suggest stuff based on what you're saying. Because if you have a conversation about something long enough, I can assure you it's going to show up on your feed.
Have you experienced this?
I've experienced that. So again, not only do they have the benefit of like being able to have unregulated advertising, but they can hear what you're saying and they can basically just make you a bespoke capitalistic or consumerist experience for you and stuff. So you know, you need to watch what you say around these socials, man. And I think it might be very interesting to like see maybe us going from like oh, like, we got a, I got a pirate tape that we should watch, but don't tell your parents and blah blah. So kids being like, nah, let's go to the park and talk in the open. Like, there's a, I found an oak tree here. See, there's an oak tree, and there's like no, there's no wires or no Wi-Fi or anything. You know, you can just have conversations that's out there. So, yeah, it might just revive like a, I guess a need for like us to be more in touch with nature. Like, yeah. You know, if you go down by the waves and the waves are crashing, you got it. No one can hear you.
Yeah.
Like, do you know when the sun goes down, it's just dark. You know, with no lights. So,
yeah. I think one area which is is still protected is humor, and I've always spoke about the fact that things like. Sarcasm is very hard to pick up and detect, and we were saying that AI will find that very difficult to replicate. Like, it's going to take years and years and years artificial intelligence to kind of,
and irony and stuff like that. And I mean, what would need to happen is that, you know, the AI will have to be aware of stuff like pain and like I said, aware of tragedy, because it's tragedy plus timing. So it would need to learn to experience pain in order to then learn to have the tools and of experience to process it, and rationalize and develop coping mechanisms, because that's what we've had to learn to do over the years. Like, instead of like, because I guess a lot of time we've had to process that, whether it's been, you know, through either through a catharsis of sorrow and crying, or whether it's like using vices and you know, and being maybe having destructive path, or even having therapy. So even the way we are processing like our emotions and our emotional spectrum, we're not even there yet. So it may take a longer time for us to do stuff like sarcasm, because like I said, a lot of this stuff is all learned behaviors that we've learned collectively as human beings over years and years and years of trial and error and stuff. So yeah, it's technology, it happens a lot quicker so far as like how its evolution than human evolution.
Yeah.
But then if technology and artificial intelligence is supposed to be start becoming more like a living organism, then when it's going to have to experience like the spectrum of like what is emotion and humanity, then yeah, it's going to probably take a very, very long time. So again, it's for me, I think it's interesting to see. And yeah, man, like I said, it's
Skynet is coming.
Skynet might be coming. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. And but even like, you know, human beings, like we're supposed to understand that we've come from like Homo erectus and like Neanderthal man. So what's next for us as well?
Yeah.
Because maybe Skynet will then give birth to our, will help create the next stage in, you know, our species' evolution. So like I said, if we are, if, you know, depending on what you believe, like God created man and man essentially killed God and tried to replace him. And then now man is going to create technology and replace us. And
I mean, I said to Marcus, I think we're the only species that's probably going to be responsible for our own extinction.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah, yeah. But then 100%. At the same time, you know, we are... As a species, we are no more distinct from the rest of life, because, you know, the Earth was here millions of years before we were. So, and other species have gone extinct.
Yeah.
Through like whatever machinations they were, they've gone extinct. So, you know, that just might be our journey. But life is not just, you know, sacrosanct to human beings. Life will go on.
It's transformative. It's gone.
Yeah. Because I'd say one interesting thing about social media in terms of the complex you have, in terms of the fact that it's your YouTube profile and it's your Twitter profile and it's what I think and this is my deepest thoughts and my opinions and stuff, is that like that that level of heightened consciousness, you can only come from a single celled organism. If you're a single celled organism, maybe that's like, for all this technology and how it's advancing, we're regressing to being a single celled organism, where we're insular and we don't actually have any physical interactions with people. We just interact on the internet. We buy stuff without leaving our house, and we get food without leaving our house. So the more insular we become, maybe we're regressing back to a single celled organism ourselves. So it's interesting to see what's going to happen.
Deep.
Brilliant.
Really like that.
Hashtag deep.
Yeah, when you deep it though. Hashtag
deep.
We always like to ask people, obviously, whether they wipe their ass standing up or sitting down on the show. We also like to ask our guests how they like
to kill. Good to know, in case you shake, when you're shaking people's hands and stuff. It's a good question to ask.
It's very valid. I know that when you leave today, you may not shake Billy Producer's hand, and that's fair enough, because he did go to the bathroom before the show.
That's why people spud these days, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah. Sometimes it's the elbow. Okay. Sometimes it's the elbow dab.
I've done the elbow dab. And I respect it.
Yeah, but just so you know, if somebody elbow daps you when you go to shake their hand, they're really not feeling your hygiene.
I don't take it personally though, man. I get it. Why Chris? I don't take it personally, man. I don't take the time. Like, it's a small thing. Someone's still greeting you, man.
So I think we've probably covered it quite a few times in the show, because you're a prolific thinker, just from the angles that you've been kind of approaching the conversation today. But what do you like to do when you're actually killing time? How do you like to kill some time?
I like, I didn't I like to read some stuff sometimes, and I'll sometimes like channel about on YouTube and just see what's happening and stuff. And mm-hmm. yeah, I just I find stuff like that interesting. I like to find out the pulse of, you know, whatever other people are thinking. So I look at a lot of the YouTube videos or podcasts and stuff. I always do try and read. I just think it's a part of my brain. I want to keep active and mm-hmm. keep healthy. So I try and read books and or magazine articles and stuff and try and read as much as I can. And yeah, and just regular stuff, man. I like and I'm into like anime, like reading mm-hmm. and watching animation and stuff as well. And eating.
Attack on Titan season 3 is coming.
I need to get up on season 2, man. Season 1 was, there's no way to explain Attack on Titan really without making somebody watch an episode, isn't it?
Them naked giants, man. You need to get with it.
Yeah, get with that.
It's just the look on their faces as they're chomping human flesh.
Yeah, but there's no malevolence in their face, man. So Attack on Titan is that for anyone that's like into stuff like, you know, Westworld or Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Attack on Titan is just like about a dystopian part of the near future where, again, human beings are not on the top of the food chain anymore.
No.
So, yeah. That's what it's about, really. And it's a good show, man. And it's interesting because, like, it just shows you that, like, the fear and stuff and hysteria that's surrounded by these titans, but really that's on the surface. But below that, there's a lot of intrigue and social manipulation and engineering that's taking place. So, yeah, it's very interesting, man. And so that's the kind of stuff I'm into and stuff as well. And, I just like traveling and stuff, man. Like, I feel very fortunate in, like, what I do for a living now, that it means I get to enjoy other stuff without feeling, oh, I've got to do this because I've got to go to work on Monday. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I just enjoy stuff like, you know, every occasional. I just going for a walk in West End and I like just window shop and, yeah, just taking humanity while you can. And I think I find it probably more enjoyable now because we're in an era of such focus on social media that, like, just taking a walk, like going to eat somewhere by myself, sometimes it's cool. I'll go watch a film mm-hmm. and just stuff, just interacting and stuff. I'm in a job where I travel all the time, I meet people all the time. So I think it's just very healthy for me to set pace in my own head and just take a walk inside my own head. And like I said, I want to be an astronaut on an astral plane. So just try and learn more about myself. And I think the more you know about yourself and the more you kind of, you know, do self-care and self-reflection, I think the more you set a standard for how you interact with other people. So that's it, man. Just try and live.
Nice.
What everyone should do, just try and live, man. Mm-hmm. Like, paint a picture. Eat something you enjoy, hang out with a friend of yours, do something, do some exercise, and yeah, take a walk, man, and just take it in, man. It's a weird time in the world now where if you can breathe clean air and drink clean water, like just revel in that sometimes.
Yeah.
Mm. So that's 100%. What I do, really.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the show today.
My pleasure, man.
Really,
it's been
appreciate
amazing.
It. And we'll put links to your website and mm-hmm. all the links to
I should say as well, so I filmed this show with, so Kevin Hart has started a new app called the LOL Network.
All right.
Oh, wow.
It's like a comedy version of YouTube.
If you've got time, let's talk about this, bro. This is great.
I did a film. So we filmed in Montreal last year and he had acts over from the UK and some acts from Canada as well, from South Africa. And so we were just filming little bits. And so that should be going up this week. So they're putting out an episode. So if you have the LOL Network, then you can download that app. And again, it's like, you know, there's someone, again, he's evolving the art and being aware of changing technology. So Kevin Hart has the streaming service, which is the LOL Network, and yeah, trying to, you know, have his stamp on comedy. And so you can find myself and a lot of good acts on there. Mm-hmm. And then also filmed at a comedy store for Comedy Central, and that's out on the 22nd of August. So yeah, so look out for that, man. So it's the Toronto Experience. I didn't get to meet Kevin Hart. So you were aware, but I did get to meet Tony Rock, who's Chris Rock's brother.
Yeah,
and also his cousin is a comic called Sherrod Small as well. So again, I was like, almost there. and they're great comics and stuff as well, man. So and just met like a few like great acts. Like there's another guy called Lisa Mandinga, who is now going to be on World's Best, which is like a new talent show for like global talent. So I met him out there. Robbie Collins, another dude who used to great comic and also open for Trevor Noah on tour as well. Mm-hmm. And then randomly was in a hotel and I saw Tretch from Naughty by Nature.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Sick.
Who again was legend. Going yeah, legend. Mm. And he was going to Russell Peters' party. So okay. Yeah, and Russell obviously Russell Peters being from Toronto and like I said being the first comedian I saw. So yeah, nice full circle. And so that should be out soon. And yeah, that was a real fun experience. And you know, for someone that was kind of weaned on North American comedians, like to perform alongside them and see these kind of guys, it was a massive opportunity. And So yeah, just to check that out, man. And yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, that's a I think it's a real big perk of the job, is like a lot of traveling and stuff. And I can't stress that. And it's tough, don't get me wrong. Like, going to Australia is like a 23-hour flight, is mad. But then once you do that, it's like you can handle any flight, yeah, basically. Mm. And also, I do get concerned about plain food. I eat it constantly. But then those are the only two things. But like, yeah, I do enjoy the traveling. And yeah, this year alone, I've been to Australia, New Zealand, Finland, Estonia, Germany, Belgium, Netherlands, the Arab Emirates. I've been to the States, and I was hoping to do more of it as well, man. I mean, I was supposed to do South Africa to do the Johannesburg Comedy Festival. It didn't happen this year, but hopefully you can sort something out in the new year. But yeah, definitely want to do some work on a continent. And Africa, Russia, and obviously the Indian subcontinent, probably the only places on earth I haven't been to. Oh yeah, and South America. Don't want to get those done. I mean, really? You could say Antarctica, but there's a very small scene there.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a joke about a cold crowd, but we won't go in there.
I read this week as well, in terms of evolution. So, you know, obviously, like, climate change, it means that, like, you see a lot of migration of, like, polar bears, for example, because their habitat is, like, being reduced.
Yeah.
Apparently, they're moving down, like, south, where, like, they are now mating with grizzly bears.
Really?
Yeah. Whoa. So polar bears and grizzly bears are apparently mating, yeah, to make a whole new, like, species.
Interracial.
So they have interracial relationships, and then, So
we really are regressing.
Yeah. So now we're going to get these, like, brown growler bears. Yeah,
growler bears.
That I hope are, like, going to be bigger than both their parents.
Make a film.
That's what I'm saying. A film. So everyone in here is a part of the screenplay, yeah?
Yes.
So you know that note, there's that film Meg that's out
Meg,
now.
Yes.
So now obviously we're going to see it grow.
There's a franchise in that, because Sharknado, everyone was laughing about that.
Yeah, we've got a franchise out of it.
There's like five films now.
This is what I'm going to say to you. Yeah. So
I like it.
Growler bears.
I like it. Also sell the rights to XNXX or Pornhub or whatever, because there's something there. Growler bear. Yeah.
sounds better than Pizzlies.
Oh, yes. Oh, man. Well, thank you once again for coming on the show.
My pleasure, man. Thank you for having me.
I appreciate you spending so much time with us as well, because you are so busy. You know, I know management's literally outside crawling at the door now. So I just appreciate you spending more than an hour with us.
My pleasure.
And you listener, you've been privileged with more than an hour of Dane Baptiste. This has been How to Kill an Hour. You can check out everything that we do at howtokillanhour.com. We've got videos, podcasts, articles, and everything. I myself have been Marcus Bronzy.
I've been Funk Butcher.
I've been Dane Baptiste.
Plenty of ways to kill some time out there. Thank you for killing some time with us.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.